Hi, I'm Mark Brewer. For 18 years, I ran the Michigan Democratic Party. These days, I'm a lawyer and consultant to progressive nonprofits, political parties, candidates, and ballot question committees.
I'm Jeff Timmer. I battled with Mark and the Democrats for decades as executive director of the Michigan GOP and while advising Republican candidates at the local, state, and national level. Now I'm a political nomad who's put what's best for the country above carrying water for my former political party.
This is a republic if you can keep it. Inside the backrooms of Michigan politics with veteran political strategists Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
Welcome back to A Republic If You Can Keep It. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by one of the nation's top experts on gerrymandering, David Daley, author of Rat Fucked, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count, and Unrigged, How Americans Are Fighting Back to Save Democracy. But first, Mark, let's do some introspection. Both of us were in the news this week, and we owe it to our listeners to provide the inside story on our own stories.
That's right, Jeff. So I want to start by talking about recalls and your recall project. I don't know if our listeners know, but Jeff was one of the co-authors of the changes in the recall laws back in 2012, which made it much more difficult to recall legislators and others in this state. That was a reaction to a successful Democratic recall of a Republican state representative from Genesee County. But that's the backstory, that it's now, frankly, much more difficult to recall people in this state. But you announced this week that you're willing and going ahead with recalls of Republican legislators who vote for these voter suppression bills. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, I've taken very seriously the threat of Trump and Trumpism and the danger and the damage, the assault on our democracy and our democratic institutions. We saw it in glowing technicolor between the November election and the certification and the Electoral College meeting in December, the events leading up to and including January 6th, and then the period until Joe Biden was sworn in as president. There was this concerted, deliberate lying propaganda assault on the very foundations of democracy and a deliberate attempt to overturn, nullify our votes across the country, especially in states like Michigan. We had several legislators, more than half of those currently serving in the Michigan Senate, those Republicans, signed a letter urging Congress to throw out our votes. And now in several states, including Michigan, they're looking to change voting laws to give themselves latitude in future elections that they feel they lacked to overturn the last election. It's effectively weaponizing the vote counting process to whoever controls the state capitol will now control and determine who wins the election, regardless of how many votes a candidate gets. And that's a danger not only with the Republicans, who I've been doing battle with over the last few years, but it's a danger in the hands of any party. No one should have that power. And so I have said, look, if you're going to go this route, and especially if you're going to go the route of a petition drive that presents the legislature with sufficient number of signatures, which is a very low number, 340,000 signatures out of 10 million people in Michigan, that the legislature on a straight party line vote can then end around the governor and circumvent the maybe abide by the black letter of the law, but certainly circumvent the intent of the law and the spirit of democracy. If you're going to go that route, that's a nuclear option that you're exercising. And so I'm prepared to exercise a nuclear option of my own, go straight to DEFCON 1 and build a coalition, deploy the resources to force these people to a recall special election this November or next May, which the law from 2012 specifies as the only allowable dates. We will force these people to recall ballots. They might think they can win. They might win. Some of them, I would think they're not going to win all of them. This will create havoc and uncertainty in Michigan politics for the next year. It's not a choice that I've made, but it's an extent that I'm willing to go.
I agree with you, Jeff. You know, Michigan's got a great history of bipartisan, nonpartisan election administration. You know, we've had some very contentious elections, but overall, our bipartisan county boards, our bipartisan state board of canvassers that you once served on, have worked. And we've had a lot of great nonpartisan staff, particularly at the state level, who've been administering our elections. And that system has worked. It's been contentious, but neither party should be able to manipulate election results, block certification in order to have their way. So I got to tell you, I saw your tweet last Friday, and then I'm monitoring it, and I see 2 million likes. And I had to do a double take when I saw 2 million likes in a matter of a few days to that tweet. So what's going on? What's been the reaction to your recall announcement?
Well, maybe a fit of pique on a Friday afternoon. I'm very serious about the recalls, but the outpouring that I've received since has been just tremendous and beyond anything I could have imagined. People all across Michigan, thousands upon thousands of people have replied to me on social media, or hit my DMs on social media, or sent me emails or texts. Apparently, it's not that hard for strangers to find me, which is a little scary, but I have gotten thousands of requests for how can I help? How can I circulate petitions? Where can I give money? I mean, I've got thousands and thousands of people asking to give money, and I wish I had the website to direct people to right now. But maybe by Wednesday we can insert that into this into this edited conversation. So the outpouring has been tremendous, and people. This is not just a Michigan battle. This is a battle for the soul of the republic, the idea of America. As great as it is and as imperfect as it has been, people want to defend it. And they saw what happened in Georgia with the legislature changing the laws in a way that makes it more difficult for people to vote. They see it happening in other states. They see it happening in Michigan. And what Michigan's system allows through these recalls and other measures is a different points where people can get involved and stop this from happening. All it takes right now with the two vacancies in the state Senate, all it takes right now is for two Republicans to say, wait a minute, this isn't a good idea. And they don't have the votes to pass it. Two people who are willing to not necessarily go against their party, but just say, wait a minute, maybe these, you know, now 50 CEOs of the leading companies in the state who say this isn't a good idea, the thousands and thousands, millions, quite honestly, of voters in Michigan who oppose this, maybe we should step back and figure out if there are smart things to do in our election laws that we can agree to in a bipartisan fashion, by all means, let's do them. But if something is going to be this contentious in this divisive climate that we live in right now, this political cultural divide, if we're just going to be pouring gas on the fire, it feels like a wrong thing to do. So maybe it is the wrong thing to do. All it takes is two people to pause and we have an impasse. It just takes three Republicans of good conscience and good character in the state House to pause. Are there five good Republicans or even Republicans who aren't bad in Lansing? I believe so. I hope so. I know these people. I know that I know many of them to be good people. Good people can choose wrong paths. I hope some of them choose not to walk down this one.
So if I can ask, though, it sounds like this is not an empty threat by you. You're organizing. It sounds like you're setting up a website to receive contributions. I mean, you're ready to carry this through. This is not just some verbal.
No. This is going to happen. We have a super PAC. We have, you know, there will be a website. There will be ability for people all across the country to donate in any amount. They can give us $1 or they can give us $1 million. And we are prepared. We know we're going to have the resources. There will be resources to force any Republican who votes for this, who doesn't denounce this, who doesn't put the brakes on this. We will be able to force all 20 in the Senate and all 55 in the House, if necessary, two special elections. And that sounds maybe hyperbolic. Maybe some don't believe it. But they're going to start seeing recall petitions in their districts this summer. And, you know, believe it then.
I look forward, Jeff, to helping you make that happen. I hope it's not necessary, but I look forward to helping you in that important task if we have to.
Well, also in the news this week is, Mark, you are leading the battle to stop a petition drive aimed at circumventing both Governor Whitmer and the voters and jamming through a bill permanently crippling any future governor's ability to quickly respond in an emergency. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Folks know about this law that the governor, I think, has very successfully used to get us through the pandemic. It gives her emergency powers. It's a law that dates to 1945. Passed by a Republican legislature, signed by a Republican governor, used by Democratic and Republican governors ever since. And it's been really key to Governor Whitmer getting us through the pandemic. But as you pointed out a moment ago, there is a unique, only one other state has it, almost unique mechanism in the Michigan Constitution where a few hundred thousand signatures on petitions can give the legislature the ability to make a change in the law and bypass the governor. In this case, there was a petition drive started last spring called Unlock Michigan, which gathered signatures, and they're trying to follow that path to bypass the governor and repeal this law, which I think we're going to need again. I mean, pandemics are not going away. There are going to be more pandemics and other emergencies like them. But I'm one of the lawyers for the opposition group, Keep Michigan Safe, and we discovered a lot of criminal wrongdoing in the course of the petition drive. So when they filed their signatures, they filed in October. We just recently were able to do the actual challenge. You know, we went through the signatures. We found a lot of defective signatures. The form of the petition itself is quite defective, and you know that from your work on the Board of Canvassers, how important the form is. We also raised the issue that this Board of Canvassers really has no rules. They've got a lot of practices that they've used over the years to review and approve petitions, but they're supposed to make rules by state law, and they've never done that. So we went to the Board of Canvassers last week and said, look, you need rules. You need to do an investigation. This petition is defective, and you should not let this small minority of people repeal this very, very important law. We ended up with a deadlock in front of the Board of Canvassers, which means that the petition was not approved. And I expect that, you know, within days, Unlock Michigan will be bringing a lawsuit, probably in the Michigan Supreme Court, to resolve this. And we will be there making all of our arguments in defense of this law. I mean, look, I believe in the initiative process, like anybody else, but you've got to follow the rules. You've got to collect signatures legally. You've got to have a petition that meets all the form requirements. You can't have criminal conduct and expect to get away with that, et cetera. And so those are very legitimate issues that we have raised on behalf of Keep Michigan Safe in order to try to derail this very dangerous petition drive.
Well, it sounds like you're doing excellent work here. And having sat in the seat of those trying to pass and get petitions through the Board of Canvassers and sat as a member of that board trying to determine this, I agree that there are certain aspects of that job as a canvasser in which your hands are tied, and there are certain aspects that have never been ventured or that certainly are a unexplored territory or gray area. And if you can just do anything and submit these petitions with defects, with criminality, then what's the point of having this process? What's the point of having this board if there is no ability to ask questions, to intervene, to halt, to challenge, to question? Then it should just become a perfunctory machine process and take humans out of it. And clearly, that wasn't the intent of the Constitutional Convention, whether it was the 1963 or 08 or before then, wherever they created this, I don't know. But to take all human discretion out of a process makes no process then if you're going to involve those humans.
Yeah, this process has been thoroughly corrupted by dark money, by criminal conduct and everything else. And there's going to be more coming out in the coming days that we've uncovered about this petition drive. And so we're going to be talking about it a lot. You know, we can talk for hours about campaign finance reform. But when people see the amount of dark money, undisclosed money, secret money that was used to fund this petition drive, this was no grassroots rebellion against the governor's powers. This was an orchestrated power play by Senator Mike Shirky and others using dark money to try to corrupt the process here. And we are doing our best to put a stop to it.
Well, I know, I personally know and have been friends with many of these actors who are involved in this or potentially involved in this. And I know many to be good people. I also know that in politics or in other aspects of life, good people can choose to do wrong things. And it sounds like people may have chosen or whether purposefully or inadvertently gone down a path they should not have gone down. And I am very curious to see how this plays out. And I hope you're successful in this, because I do think these powers are essential to effective governing. I know John Engler, wouldn't have rolled over and let the legislature, take away, his very real and necessary powers. I'm glad to see that Governor Whitmer and others are defending that for the office, not for the office holder.
That's right. It's a real important check and balance that we have here. Again, I believe in the citizen initiative process, but it's got to be done by the rules, and it can't be done in a corrupt, illegal fashion, which is exactly what we've got here. And that's what the ongoing fight's going to be about.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by author David Daly.
Mark and Jeff will be back after these messages.
Epic MRA is pleased to be a sponsor of this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, federal, state, and local issues. Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, and local governments across the state. When it comes to measuring voter opinions, Epic MRA has been known as the go-to Michigan pollster for over 25 years. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
The Michigan Polycast. It's been called one of Michigan's top political podcasts by Hourly Detroit.
Each week, longtime political junkies Christine Barry and Walt Sorg offer news and views on Michigan politics and policy, as well as national issues impacting our pleasant peninsulas. And they are joined by some of the state's biggest names from government, politics, academia, and nonprofit groups, with an in-depth look at those issues.
Subscribe now to the Michigan Polycast, online at www.michiganpolycast.com.
The U.S. Census Bureau released the first of its 2020 reports in the last few days, and as expected, Michigan is one of seven states losing a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. The population shifts and reallocation of House seats will launch the every 10 years battle over drawing congressional maps and legislative maps in state capitals. Joining us today, an expert in the political gamesmanship of redistricting.
David Daly is a senior fellow for Fair Vote and the author of Rat Fund, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy, which helped spark the recent drive to reform partisan gerrymandering. Dave's second book, Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy, chronicles the victories and defeats in state efforts to reform elections and uphold voting rights.
Daly is a frequent lecturer and media source about gerrymandering. He is the former editor-in-chief of Salon.com and the former CEO and publisher of the Connecticut News Project. He is a digital media fellow at the Wilson Center for the Humanities and the Grady School of Journalism at the University of Georgia. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Washington Post, The Guardian, New York Magazine, The Atlantic, Boston Globe, Rolling Stone, and he's been on CNN, NPR, and many other networks. When writing for the Hartford Courant, he helped identify Mark Felt as the deep throat source for Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein.
Welcome, David, and thanks for joining the conversation this week.
Thanks for having me. Good to be with you both.
Well, I think it's great to see David Daly here. My co-host Mark Brewer and David Daly are the only two people that I can think of who've gotten me to open up and talk about some of the secrets behind redistricting, you know, pull my skirts up, as it were. David was able to do it with a cup of coffee. It took Mark a subpoena to make me talk. But ironically, it happened at the same place. David, in his book, Rat Fucked, about redistricting, talks about having coffee with me at Big B. Those in Michigan will know the Senate Big B. There's a distinction. Sitting in front, a table in front of the window, and that table is the same one where Mark served me the subpoena to appear in the federal gerrymandering trial. I remember that very well.
There ought to be a plaque there. That would be great.
Yeah, we should put a bronze marker on that sidewalk, Jeff, where I served you with the
subpoena. And I had coffee with David Daly for his book. Anyway, David, welcome. You've been looking at redistricting all around the country for a long time and wrote a very eye-opening book about the process 10 years ago. And we had news this week. The official reapportionment numbers have come out, with the states being allocated their population and seats through whatever kind of mystical formula Congress uses to determine, or the Census Bureau uses to determine that. And so now we know where the seats are going to shift. And to most of our listeners who are Michigan-based, Michigan, in yet another decade, is losing a seat. But I'm curious how you see, 10 years ago, there was a very concerted effort that you wrote about in your book by the Republicans to capture state legislatures in 2010 and use that to catapult themselves into a decade of majority in 2011 in redistricting. Is there anything similar or parallel going on right now, or are both sides doing it based on what happened 10 years ago?
You know, I don't think that there necessarily needed to be one this time, because the Republican efforts in 2011 really lasted the entire decade. When you look at the chambers that Republicans targeted in 2010, and quite effectively. I mean, Republicans had a big year. It's the Tea Party year. It was the first midterm of a Democratic president. So it historically tends to be a big year for the party that's out of power. But Republicans had a really strategic idea to try to capture as many of these swing state legislatures as they could, but also the states that were going to be gaining or losing a seat, because it's in those states that you have to tear up the entire map and start all over again. And it gives you, you know, a terrific opportunity to go wild on the map. And I don't think, certainly Democrats tried very hard to fight back in 2018 and in 2020 to try to win back seats at the table for this upcoming cycle. They really weren't able to be successful anywhere, not in Pennsylvania, not in Wisconsin, not in Michigan, not in Ohio, not in Florida. And as a result of that, in the states where Republicans have been able to hold on to the governorship, they will continue to have complete control of the process. Michigan, of course, went ahead and adopted an independent commission in 2018. So the fact that the legislature's been able to hold on so long under these maps will not affect the process moving forward. But in all these other states, Republicans really are still going to be in the catbird seat. And it's largely going to be thanks to the efforts in 2011.
David, let me take another angle on this. You know, many of us were disappointed by the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Rucho case, right, where the court finally said, after 30 years of dallying in this whole area, that there's no federal cause of action for partisan gerrymandering. They tossed out our verdict here in Michigan and in several states across the country. But we've seen Supreme Courts, state Supreme Courts, step in. Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which I think is still controlled by Democrats, threw out their map. I think the North Carolina Supreme Court is still controlled by Democrats. So it may be that there's a new player here, at least in some of these states, right? Those two in particular that might, you know, help kind of level the playing field. Any thoughts on the roles that the state Supreme Courts might play going forward?
I think that's right. I mean, I was as disappointed as you were that the U.S. Supreme Court closed the doors essentially to partisan gerrymandering claims on what I thought was a particularly specious legal reasoning. And it is going to have a handful of ramifications on this next decade. First, it removes any threat of federal litigation that might have reined in some map makers and some legislatures and encouraged them to stay out of litigation and come up with something that at least colored between the lines. Without that, I think Paul Smith, when he argued the case at the court, is right. It's going to be a real unfettered festival of partisan gerrymandering as a result. Certainly, it opens the door to potential litigation in state courts. And the trouble there is instead of a one-size-fits-all standard that can be adopted throughout the entire country, you've got to file 50 different cases in 50 different states. And all of those states are under, you know, have had different ways of electing judges. And some of those states are, the courts are deeply partisan, and you're not likely to get, you know, a real remedy. So, you know, certainly in Florida, for example, you know, that's a deeply gerrymandered state. I wrote about it in Rad Fucked, in which you had citizens who enacted a constitutional amendment there in 2010 that, you know, banned all kinds of partisan gerrymandering, and it didn't make a difference. They just set up a secret shadow process and essentially ran right around it. And because of the way that justices are appointed there, it's hard to imagine that court is going to overturn whatever map comes out in, you know. The bottom line, I think, is that you ought to have just as unfettered access to a fair map if you live in Florida or if you live in, you know, Pennsylvania or North Carolina. It shouldn't depend on where you live. And the real sadness to me of what the court did in the Rucho case is that they slammed these federal courthouse doors at exactly the time that federal courts and state courts around the country, including in your case in Michigan, of course, but also in Ohio and Wisconsin and Maryland and North Carolina, were showing that there was very much a way to determine when a map had gone too far, and that there were statistical measures that could, you know, demonstrate it, and that a court could hear evidence the same way that a court hears evidence in any other trial.
Yeah, and I think the point you made about Florida will also be true in Texas.
Yeah.
You know, the Texas Supreme Court is not going to be a place where folks can go. Do you have any sense, David, about whether the Justice Department, you know, under Merrick Garland now, can have any impact on this at all, particularly with the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, Section 5, you know, several years ago? Section 2, or are they going to run into a hostile federal judiciary as well?
Section 2 is under threat at the Roberts Court right now as well. You certainly have in the Garland Justice Department a team of experienced voting right litigators, in folks like Kristen Clark. Now you have a new office of democracy at the White House that Justin Levitt is running. So there are some really bright and experienced, quite capable people who will be working on this. The question, I think, again, is whether anything can be crafted at the federal level that can find their way through a blockade at a U.S. Supreme Court that has, over the course of the last decade, become increasingly unfriendly to the idea of protecting voting rights of the average citizen?
You know, I've 10 years ago, from the perspective of many, and I'm sure many of our listeners, I was one wearing a black hat. I've switched hats in a lot of ways over the last decade, notably and very vocally, taking on my former tribe and holding them accountable for not that I've gone against what I've believed in, but I think they have. And I think I look and I see the way that they've bastardized the process. And I've looked back at 2011, and I've looked a lot at the rise of extremism, the polarization of politics. And I have done some mea culpa interviews where I recognize the preponderance of safe districts, be it on either side of the spectrum, where you are answerable in a primary election, really only answerable in a primary election and not in a November election, gives rise to this extremism where instead of kind of the normal American politics where everything is between the 35 or 40 yard lines, both sides are now kind of playing more toward their own end zones and backfields. And we're getting these just downright kooks, be they in Congress or in the state capitol. And yeah, I look at people here in Michigan, and I'm sure the name, Matt Maddock means nothing to you, but to listeners here in Michigan, I mean, this guy is a drooling kook who is one of the most powerful Republicans in the state right now. And it's people like that, that this process has given rise to and given power to, and it's been corrosive, it's been toxic, and I recognize it needs to change, and I'm doing what I can to change it.
I'm really grateful to hear you say that, and I've so admired, following you on Twitter and reading some of these interviews and pieces you've done, because I don't think everybody has completely recognized the role of redistricting and gerrymandering in creating this kind of toxicity and polarization that has come to really take over our politics. I mean, I think we in many ways live in the nation that Red Map, the Redistricting Majority Project, the GOP strategy back from 2010, created. And it had unintentional consequences of putting into power extreme lawmakers who suddenly had no accountability to really anybody at all, because they were representing districts they could not lose. The only election that mattered is a low turnout summer primary from the, hardcore of the base. November doesn't matter at all. And what that does, I think it does a lot of things. First, it gives you people like Mark Meadows. When you look at North Carolina, and this is one of my favorite examples in the country of what happened. When Republicans redrew North Carolina's congressional map in 2011, they were determined, and the state representative who talked about it at the time and who ran the process said, I'm going to do a 10-3 map because I think a 10-3 map is the best thing for Republicans and the best thing for North Carolina. And in order to draw a 10-3 map, they had to take a competitive district in the western part of the state around Asheville. And they had to essentially take Asheville, and which is the vegan hippie capital of the Western Mountains, but it's surrounded by all of the conservative towns where Eric Rudolph hid out and was protected all those years. So it's an interesting place. And it was a real swing district. In the preceding decade, in 2000, 02, 04, it is a Republican seat. And in 2006, when there's dissatisfaction with the Iraq war, you get a conservative Democrat elected from that seat, an old football quarterback.
That was Heath Shuler's district? Okay.
At Shuler's district, yeah. And when they redraw the map in 2011, Shuler takes one look at the cracked Asheville in half, and half the Democrats in that seat and half in Patrick McHenry's seat and he says, I can't win here. And he retires, takes on a, you know, much more lucrative career as an energy lobbyist. And Mark Meadows is a sandwich shop owner in a small town. And he says, I know what I'm going to do here. I'm going to get in this race. I'm going to run as a birther. You can go on and you can find the video of him talking about, I'm going to send Barack Obama back to Kenya or wherever it is he comes from. He wins the primary there with about 40% of the vote in that district. And he coasts into Congress as a result. Yeah, John Boehner doesn't like Mark Meadows any more than Barack Obama. And the feeling is mutual, right? I mean, it's Meadows who pulls the parliamentary move that ends up costing Boehner his speakership. And it's Boehner who's one of the key funders and organizers behind Red Map and the gerrymandering in Ohio. So, like, this is the blowback is that, like, a Frankenstein's monster is created with these guys in these districts. And it launched something that most of the people who created it have still not grappled with. I mean, Boehner and Paul Ryan, all of these guys are still deeply involved with Republican redistricting efforts this year. I mean, Boehner is out selling a book and, you know, talking about all of the awfulness, but he's still not grappling with what was unleashed by him as a result of this. And I think until more Republicans, more honest conservatives understand that a lot of the extremism and the toxicity and a lot of what created Trump was self-inflicted.
I agree completely. I think the Tea Party was kind of a catalyzing moment to that 2010 that put the party on a path to extremism. Trump was just gas on a fire that was already burning, kind of like that third stage rocket boost to send it into orbit. And you look at these people like, you know, a Meadows, I would never call him smart, but he was clever enough to pull the, you have people then like the Jim Jordans and the Matt Gaetz who are his performing monkeys, you know, that he was able to go out and do his dirty work to really get out in front of the cameras and say the dumb things that he was having them say. But these people rose to the point where they are the mainstream of the Republican Party. They're still the Boehners and the Paul Ryans of the world still think that this is an anomaly, that things are going to revert back to normal. Trump is now gone. They don't realize they're now the extreme, the fringe of the party. And it's the Jim Jordans and the Matt Gaetzes and the Marjorie Taylor Greens who are the mainstream, reflect the views of the predominance of Republicans in this country. And it's crazy. It's scary is what it is.
Yeah. I think, you know, in our trial, one of the experts that we had demonstrated the link between gerrymandering and policymaking, which is another way to come at what you two guys have just been talking about. He showed it. It was Chris Warshaw. He showed it in Pennsylvania. He showed how it happened in Michigan, that there's a direct link between this. Now, when the Democrats took control of the legislature back in the 60s, and after the one person, one vote revolution, you could see the same thing. You know, we had, from our perspective, you know, this huge outflowing of progressive legislation. Right. Workers' rights, environmental rights, civil rights, the whole kind of thing. But now the counter revolution is occurring, led not by the kind of folks you indicate, Jeff, but for folks here in Michigan, Corser and Gamrat.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Who are a scandalous pair who actually were so bad a few years ago, they got ousted by the Republican caucus. I'm not sure they would be ousted today.
No, they might. He'd be
speaking today. Much worse.
One of them would be leading that caucus if they were still right in the legislature. And, you know, it's given rise to this. I found a new term that I've kind of taken a shine to on Twitter this week. I call them the witless Ayatollahs that form the theocratic hierarchy of the Republican Party. And they will effectively engage in political stoning of anybody who demonstrates Harris heresy or, you know, becomes an apostate in their mind. It's kind of, I guess, another synchronicity this week is the fourth season of Handmaid's Tale debuts tomorrow. And, you know, these guys would be comfortable at the helm of Gilead. And they're not, they're illiberal. They're dangerous. Many of them are authoritarian. I've said in a recent column that this lurch toward illiberalism, I still think most people in the party are not willing to knowingly engage in full-throated authoritarianism, but they don't recognize that they're adjacent to it and enabling it, because there are people with much worse motive who are engaged in active subversion of democracy, active subversion of our votes. We saw it after the election. We're seeing it with bills moving through state legislatures right now. We've talked about it earlier on this podcast. It's what's caused me to get out and take a lead in preparing to recall Republicans in the legislature. You know, 10 years ago, if I had a time machine, I wouldn't believe my future self. Yeah. But that's where I'm at. And so I know there's a lot of people listening to this who can't believe what I'm doing either.
What we have is this epidemic of minority rule that is so deeply dangerous and anathema to what the idea of a representative democracy is supposed to be. If the politicians get too far out of step with the people, we have this vehicle called elections that's supposed to allow us to control them and rein them back in. And our elections have stopped being responsive. And a large part of that is the maps. And when politicians no longer have to fear losing an election, they can do all sorts of things, right? They can be as corrupt as they want to be, knowing that their own caucus might not rein them in. You just have to look at neighboring Ohio, which seems to have, the former Speaker of the House there, the congressman, I'm sorry, the state rep from North Carolina, who I talked about at the beginning, who was in charge of drawing those maps, David Lewis, had to resign in a financial campaign, a contribution scandal of his own. So you see it on the policy side. Politicians feel perfectly able and willing to go to extremes, and there's nothing that voters can do about it. And that is what has to be changed. And it has to be changed before all of these gerrymandered and insulated legislatures continue to pass these horrific voting rights bills that are really designed to lock themselves in power. I wish we could stop talking about this in many ways through Republican and Democratic angles. And I think it's, this isn't about which party wins. It's about being able to go to the polls and have responsive elections in which our voices are heard and our voices matter. And that's what is slipping away from us in a really dangerous way. And I don't think that's hyperbole.
Well, David, I'm going to put it on you. What can we reformers do? I mean, are there answers? I got to tell you, in Michigan here, we have these very difficult recall laws, very hard. We have some of the worst lobbying and ethics laws in the country. So it's hard to even know what's going on behind the scenes in terms of the corruption. And now the gerrymandered districts. Now, maybe our commission will help us get a little bit out of that. But that's just Michigan. I mean, what is going to happen in the other states like Indiana, where they can't do a ballot proposal, right? But they have a terribly gerrymandered process. And my friends in Indiana tell me the Republicans are going to do it again. They're going to gerrymander the state. So I'm just trying to figure out, is there anything we can do in terms of state by state or kind of breaking through this and fixing it? I don't mean to put that all on you, but any ideas based on all the research you've done, all the thinking you've done on this?
I have come to think that the best way forward on this is to rethink the idea of single member districts altogether. There's a congressman from Virginia, Don Beyer, who's got something called the Fair Representation Act, which combines larger multi-member districts that are harder to gerrymander and ranked choice voting that would re-incentivize politicians to talk to everybody again and not just their base, and would make it possible for them to go to Washington and actually govern and form coalitions together and solve problems rather than being afraid that, you know, talking to the wrong person or shaking the wrong politician's hand on a tarmac would lead to a primary challenge. I think we have to really think big here, because the structural problems are worsening as polarization deepens, as, you know, as our geographical polarization worsens. This isn't going to solve itself. And in many ways, I think we have to fix this idea of single member winner takes all before we can get at just about anything else. I mean, and I'm talking to you from Massachusetts. Massachusetts has 9 members, and they're all Democrats. They haven't elected a Republican here since 1994 to Congress. But there are plenty of Republicans in the state of Massachusetts. We always elect Republican governors, right? We've had
almost always, yeah.
We've had one Democratic governor here since the days of Michael Dukakis.
Who was on our show. He was a guest of ours 2 weeks ago.
Oh, that's amazing. He's fantastic. If you email Michael Dukakis, he will email you back.
I found that out.
You know, so if you really, even if you had an independent commission here in Massachusetts, you would struggle to draw a Republican seat simply because of the way people are divided up. But if you drew 3 districts of 3 and you used ranked choice voting, so all it took was a 33% plus 1 to get a seat, suddenly you would have a much more proportional balance to the delegation. Massachusetts Republicans would actually have a voice again. And how great would it be to have New England Republicans in Congress again, or some, you know, Midwestern Southern Democrats? Those are the people who kind of grease the wheels and make the legislation move. They're the oil. So I think that's really the solution we ought to be looking at.
When you say New England Republicans, my mind immediately jumps to Susan Collins, and I don't think of her as the oil that makes politics worth.
Yeah.
She's an island Republican by geography only.
Yeah.
not the style that you meant.
Your idea of proportional representation is so attractive. I have friends who are, you know, active in governments in Europe and some in Asia. And I look at those proportional voting systems. You know, they use party lists. That's one mechanism. The way you described is another. I think if you could adopt that though uniformly across the country, right? Because I can see that becoming a partisan tool, right? That it's adopted in a way that strengthens one party or the other. But yes.
Yeah, Massachusetts is not going to agree to it because you would lose 3 seats right away.
Right.
You'd have to do this via statute, and it would require repealing the single district a mandate that the Congress passed back in the 1960s. But, you know, I think it's more than a thought experiment now. I mean, I think people realize in a lot of ways that commissions can be great. And I think in a state like Michigan, it will give you a fairer map than the ones you've probably had there lately.
Can't be worse.
But
you know. I agree. After 10 years, I agree.
But what are you going to do in Massachusetts? What are you going to do in Kansas? I mean, we have a gerrymandering problem and we have a geography problem. And it's often said that too often we blame geography for states like Pennsylvania or Wisconsin or or Michigan or Ohio, you know, and folks say, well, you know, it's just that all the Democrats are concentrated in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, and the rest of the state is Republican. We know from the kind of mathematical models that have been done over the course of the last decade testing this, that that's not the case. There's a pretty good distribution of red and blue across all of these states that are competitive. What happened in those states is that they were gerrymandered to hell and beyond. But in states like Oklahoma, in states like Utah, in Massachusetts, in Connecticut, in Kansas, those states have a geography problem. And if we're going to fairly represent everyone, we have to find a way to get around single member districts.
We're getting the gong from our producer. We've already chewed up 30 minutes. And so this is a kind of conversation that I could go on with for a long time. And I hope as this process goes on over the next year, as the commission plays out here in Michigan, as the process goes on in other states, that we can have you come back and talk about what we're seeing. I think we recognize some of the danger signs. We know some of the pitfalls. Let's regroup as we move through the year and talk about this and kind of do a play-by-play, because I think we're going to see a patch work of some success stories. Hopefully Michigan will be one, but I think we're going to see some very egregious attempts to really skew the lines in places like Florida and Texas and Georgia or in New York.
Well, I was about to jump in there and play the nonpartisan and say what I think you're going to see in New York, in Illinois, are going to be really over the line attempts to, and some Democrats might say, well, we have no choice to do this because we have to make up for, you know, Texas and Florida and North Carolina. But this is why we need a national systemic approach that puts real standards on this. It's ought to be about voters. These district lines are the building blocks of our democracy. And when they get warped, this is what we get. We get a government that's incapable of protecting us during a pandemic. And we have a chance now to start over and fix it.
That's a great way to end this. David Daly, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for those thoughts.
Anytime at all. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, David.
That's our time for this week. Our great thanks to David Daly for joining the conversation.
We welcome your comments on the podcast. You can talk back to us by email, comments@arepublicpodcast.com, or add your comments to our Facebook page.
And if you would, share the link to this podcast on your social media. We've already added listeners in 46 states and 28 countries, and would love to see that expand even further.
And if the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. Thanks very much for listening.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, arepublicpodcast.com. A Republic If You Can Keep It with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.